Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Hi, I'm Paul Listick, and welcome to Behind the Curtain. Welcome, everybody, to Paul Listick Behind the Curtain for WGN Radio, the podcast here where I get to talk about things other than politics, usually a lot of theater, whatever. But, you know, now we're going to revert back to a world that includes politics. It's politics, it's law, and it's a story that is so much on the front burner and headlines. Of course, you all know about the case Roe versus Wade. It is facing possible extinction this year from the Supreme Court. We'll find out in June. But there's an incredible book that came out called The Family Roe, An American Story. It goes in places that you might not expect a book about Roe versus Wade to go. The author is Joshua Prager, who's written for Vanity Fair, The New York Times, Wall Street Journal. He's the author of this book. When I read this book, I got to him. I said, Joshua, please join me. We have to talk about that. He agreed, and here he is. Joshua, welcome and congratulations on this amazing book.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you're not a lawyer, you're a journalist. I'm not going to turn you into a lawyer, but I want to set the pace from a journalist perspective, which is yours, because right now, you know, we pick every day, we're hearing about the Texas case with 6 weeks, and then there's the Mississippi case with 15 weeks and all of that. So your sense of the way things are developing, and we will get the answers come June, but just because of all the work you've done on this book and you know what's going on, you're on so many cable stations where they try and turn you into a lawyer, what is your sense of where things stand right now and what people should be ready for?
Yeah, I think that the Mississippi case is really what matters, because it was engineered. It was brought to go right to the heart of the matter in terms of Roe v. Wade. It, of course, challenges the viability threshold, the idea that abortion is legal until roughly the end of the second trimester, when the fetus can survive outside of the womb. And, you know, the Mississippi case concerns a law that's at 15 weeks instead of viability at roughly 24 weeks. It looks sort of, you know, reading the tea leaves, the lawyers have made it quite clear, and even those of us who aren't lawyers, listening to the justices, the ones we really need to pay attention to, like Justice Amy Coney Barrett, Justice Kavanaugh, those potential swing justices, it does look like from their questions that they are ready to actually overturn Roe and to say that, you know, we will now get rid of the viability threshold. And the thing that I think people need to realize as a result of that, that doesn't mean now that abortion will suddenly move, the legality of abortion will move from 24 weeks to 15 weeks. It means that all pre-viability abortion bans are now going to be constitutional. And so we'll, of course, go back to the states. And then we know that if Roe is overturned, there are 12 states already that have these sort of trigger bans in effect, meaning that abortion will be illegal from conception. And not surprisingly, in this divided country, abortion will be legal in roughly half and illegal in roughly half. And that, as always, it will be the sort of poor and disenfranchised who will struggle to have access to legal abortion.
And I'm going to take you into the book, but I'm going to do it from my perspective as a lawyer. You'll understand in a minute. The point being that what has stunned me as a lawyer, as I cover this case on television, is that abortion, whether you agree with it or not, that's not what this is about. Abortion has been deemed by the court a fundamental right back in '90. That's what Roe versus Wade said. It's a fundamental right that women have. And so what's been stunning about these cases that have been going through is not that they're dealing with the issues, but is that they have allowed the Texas law in Texas to remain in effect, as opposed to saying, wait a minute, we'll figure out what we're doing. But until then, an existing constitutional law, hey, that's gotta remain in effect. So that law has to be postponed. They didn't do that. And of course, people say they just don't understand the position it's put women into. But here's how I go into the book with you. So that's the current perspective of people who are worried about women and talking about women. But here's the thing. Jane Roe was a woman too, a real woman. She's not with us anymore, but her name was Norma McCorvey. And what's amazing about this book, you knew her, you talked to her, you interviewed her. Tell us about the real Jane Roe.
I will tell you about her. You know, what is fascinating, I'll just comment one quick comment on the Texas law that you mentioned. You know, obviously people who oppose Roe, they've come up over the 50 years since Roe was brought to the Supreme Court with all sorts of sort of novel ways to attack it. And what they did in Texas, of course, was unprecedented in terms of deputizing private citizens to sort of, you know, say, hey, you, anyone, whether it's the woman, whether it's the doctor performing abortion or the person driving the woman to the abortion provider, those people can bring suit. And that's what I think was so fascinating and novel about that Texas case. In terms of Norma, yeah, she was a real woman. And in many ways, she was the perfect person to sort of be the plaintiff, Jane Roe, because she was ambivalent about abortion. And even though, and she swung from the pro-choice side to the pro-life side many years after her plaintiffship. And she said what people paid her to say, you know, and what I mean by that, she wasn't actually paid to switch sides, but she gave speeches on the pro-choice side, gave speeches on the pro-life side. But she actually did have an opinion. And a few days after Roe was decided in 1973, in a little interview she gave to the Baptist Press, she said that she believed that abortion ought to be legal through the end of the first trimester. And she repeated that exact position to me on her deathbed. I was with her at the end of her life, and she believed that exact same thing. And that is what a majority of Americans believe. So in a sense, her ambivalence and her contradictions and her complexities, they mirrored sort of, you know, the American position. But to tell you a little bit just about the person quickly, you know, she grew up in a broken home. She was a quote unquote delinquent child sent away to sort of schools for problem children. She came out to her mom as a lesbian when she was in her early teens. Her mother beat her for that. Sex and religion were often seen as completely incompatible in her home. They were Jehovah's Witnesses, and it was a difficult thing for Norma. She then got married at the age of 16, had a child, gave that child up for adoption to her mother, had another child, gave that child up for adoption to a family she didn't know. She'd already been divorced. And she was pregnant for the third time in 1969, when then she found the lawyer Linda Coffey and became Jane Roe. So it was her third unwanted pregnancy. And she never had the abortion. She gave up all three children to adoption. And what's so interesting about that is, of course, the pro-life want to say that, hey, abortion takes an emotional toll on women, and they point to Jane Roe as proof of that. But in fact, she never had the abortion. And if she's proof of anything, it's the emotional toll that adoption takes on a woman. So it's a complicated story.
And what's really, you know, you sort of, I know you do so many interviews, you sort of toss out she never had the abortion as though that's a side point. But the thing is, if you were to, I think if you took a poll of Americans and said, did Jane Roe have an abortion? Did Norma have it? They went, oh, yeah, of course. You interviewed that kid. Her name is Shelley. She's 50 years old today. She is. Talk about her and what, I mean, imagine being the focus of a case where you could have been aborted, but you weren't.
Yeah, you're exactly right. I, like most Americans, assumed, of course, Jane Roe had the abortion that she sought. She won her case. But then when you think about it, you say, hey, wait a minute. And a law case takes longer than a pregnancy. And when I realized that, I said, oh, my God, that means somewhere there is a child whose very conception occasioned the Roe lawsuit. And looking online, I saw that the pro-life talked about this unknown person as the Roe baby. And they saw her as whoever she was, as the sort of living incarnation of their argument against abortion. And I wanted to find that person. And I assumed that whoever she was, she had found out who she'd been born to. And when I then did find her, I ended up finding her through Norma's private papers, which Norma had left in a garage where she'd lived previously, in the garage of a home where she'd lived with her former partner, a woman named Connie Gonzalez. When I found those papers, on one piece of paper there was a date of birth, which eventually led me to this person named Shelley Thornton. I first reached out to the woman who raised her, just in case Shelley hadn't known who she'd been born to. But yes, she had, and she'd never told her story before. And it was a fascinating story. She didn't like to be looked at as a symbol. She knew that the pro-life looked at her, as I said, as their sort of argument against abortion. And she hated carrying a secret. She felt that any day she can sort of be outed. And people would look at her not as Shelley Thornton, but rather as the Roe baby. So she tells her story in my book for the first time. And it's a very powerful story.
And I want people to read the book, so I don't want to give too much away, but But Shelley Thornton herself, how does she view her role? I mean, I know the answer because I've read your book, but you know, she could have been somebody who said, oh, wow, I'm that baby. I could become a millionaire just by going on, mm-hmm. you know, I could see the movie in my speeches. Now I'm the row baby.
Yeah, you're right. She That's not who she is. Not, you know, she as it's fascinating as much the way Shelley found out who she was originally was the National Enquirer, the tabloid, reached out to her. They tracked her down in a parking lot near where she lived in Washington State when she was just shy of her 19th birthday. And they said, hey, we're going to press whether you like it or not. She was terrified. A lawyer prevailed upon them to not include her name. But she wanted from that point forward to have nothing to do with Roe or Norma. And Norma, of course, wanted everything to do with Roe. She basically turned her plaintiffship into a career. And Shelley and her mother, Norma and Shelley, never actually met, but they had a few very painful conversations over the phone. And the last time they ever spoke, Norma actually says to her that she needs to thank her for not aborting her. And setting aside that Norma wanted to have the abortion, it's a terrible thing to say to someone. Shelley was disgusted by that and said, as much as Norma sort of clung to her plaintiffship and to Roe, I am going to push it aside. And so though she and her sisters, the other children Norma had given birth to and given up for adoption, though they are all sort of nominally pro-choice, they don't believe that abortion ought to be legal. Nonetheless, they also are sort of ambivalent about it. To use their words, they don't believe that abortion ought to be a form of birth control. It's a very complicated thing in their lives and in the country at large. You know, in approaching this book, I mentioned in my author's note that I'm pro-choice, but I did not write this book as an advocate. I wrote it, as you mentioned, as a journalist. And to me, it's obvious that abortion is fraught for good reason. And I try to tell both sides of the story in very human terms. And I think that's what sort of separates my book from other books about Roe, which are so political.
In fact, I want to, since you brought that up, you write it as a journalist and you divulge your position in it, which I guess you have to, right? I mean, journalists never sort of say where they stand, but you felt it was important that people know what your position is. Part of what you dialogue with, I think towards the end of the book, part of an epilogue type thing, but you sort of say, look, I needed to even wrestle with what terms I used, because use the word pro-life, you're kind of taking a position and making a point when you just use that word, or you say anti-abortion.
That's right. It's amazing. It's like a minefield. And I tried to find sort of a middle ground. So I allowed the two sides to call themselves what they wanted, pro-life and pro-choice. But I also drew the line somewhere, you know, with language. For example, I don't think that a fertilized cell, a single cell, a zygote, is the same thing as a child, which the pro-life sort of will point to and say, aha, so you're on the other side. But again, I was fair, you know, and I cut through the propaganda and the rhetoric on both sides. There are things in my book that are sort of, you know, that can be weaponized by both sides. You know, to say something that is against the pro-choice side that I write about, the lawyer who argued the case in front of the Supreme Court, Sarah Weddington, she treated Norma horribly. She treated her co-counsel, Linda Coffey, horribly. And I tell her story. I tell it like it is, because I think that really what matters here is truth. And there's so much sort of, you know, myth that has attached itself to this story. And people should be able to sort of, in my opinion, tell, you know, have your opinion, say, I believe that abortion ought to be legal or not illegal, but at least be honest about it. And that's the line I tried to tell in my book.
So Norma died back in 2017. I think I have that right. And which also means you've been working on this book for a very long time, because you were obviously in the research process at that point. So you couldn't have known what was about to happen with regard to Mississippi and Texas and all the ways things shaped up. In fact, back when you started working on this book, I imagine you might have had a sense that the abortion world, other than maybe certain, you know, Planned Parenthood versus Casey restrictions that would come up, you might have thought, well, it's kind of a settled area. So why did you write this?
I absolutely did. It was shocking to me. I started in 2010. And so the fact that it's timely now is crazy to me. The reason I started this is I had written often about people whose lives were attached to history and who had secrets. And I'm fascinated by secrecy and history. There are often these big unknowns that sort of hide themselves in these narratives that we know well. And the idea that somewhere there was a Roe baby, that's what brought me into this story. But then what happened was, you know, when I then found the answer by unearthing Norma's private papers. And I started looking through those papers. I said, my God, there's so much here. And all the stories that Norma had told, that Jane Roe had told, they're nonsense. She was not honest about who she was. She lied constantly about both sides. And her story led me to Roe, which in turn led me to even the larger story of abortion in America. And I saw the issues that have turned abortion into this sort of civil war in America. They were reflected in Norma's story herself. So to give an example, you know, Norma was the third consecutive generation in her family that had had an unwanted pregnancy. And these unwanted pregnancies, they cast them, they really upended these women's lives. So, for example, Norma's mother was a woman named Mary. At 17, she gets pregnant. She doesn't want to, she's not married. Her family makes her leave their tiny town along the Atchafalaya River in Louisiana. She has to go to the big city in Baton Rouge. She then gives birth, and they then take that child away from her to raise as their own. Well, that trauma made Norma's mother never the same again. She became an alcoholic. She started sleeping with all sorts of men that she served alcohol to in the little bars where she worked. And that then in turn informed the home that Norma grew up in. And so in my opinion, the incompatibility in this country between sex and religion is really the single biggest reason why abortion is so fought in this country. And so I wanted to show the result of that incompatibility in very human terms to help explain how we got here.
You make the point in the book that as you read this, yes, it's about abortion, you know, the topic and all of that, but you say arguably it's related to gay rights. It's related to abortion access. Yep. It's related. So yep. You obviously talk about the broader purpose of your book, see, because you know what, whatever happens in June, your book, The Family Row, will continue to exist and be on shelves.
Yeah, you know, what's fascinating is that I didn't know this. There were basically back in the late 1960s, early 70s, there were these two big fights for gay rights, fights for women's rights. Norma was gay. Her lawyer, Linda Coffey, was gay. The lawyer who introduced Norma to her lawyer, Henry McCluskey, was gay. He was actually fighting these sodomy laws in Texas. So there were these sort of two fights going on. And what ends up happening, no one would have predicted that all these years later, you know, gay marriage would be sort of ho-hum in this country, and we'd still be sort of, you know, fighting for women's rights, that issue would sort of continue to be the sort of third rail. In my opinion, the biggest reason why that is because when you know somebody, when you love somebody, it's difficult to deny them a right that you enjoy. So if we all know someone who's gay in our lives, our uncle, our brother, our child, we say, even though I might not have sort of initially thought so, yeah, why shouldn't that person have the right to marry? But there's so much stigma, so much shame that attaches itself to abortion, even though it's something that tens of millions of women have in this country. One out of four women in their lifetimes will have an abortion, but they don't talk about it. And so to humanize the issue as I do, I think it makes it much more understandable sort of how we got here. And I'll just tell you a fascinating thing. So Justice Blackmun, who wrote the opinion, he was appointed by President Nixon, you know, a Republican president to the Supreme Court. But Justice Blackmun's daughter, Sally, had gotten unhappily pregnant in college. She ends up miscarrying, but it changes her life forever. She had a shotgun marriage, later gets divorced. Another justice on the court, Justice Powell, also appointed by a Republican president, by Nixon. He was a lawyer at a law firm. When one of the messenger boys at his firm comes to him and says, hey, my girlfriend just got pregnant. We didn't want to have the child. I brought her to an illegal abortion provider. My girlfriend then died during that procedure. I'm now wanted for manslaughter. Please help me. And Justice Powell did help him. The point being that when someone knows someone who had an abortion, when someone is connected to something, it changes their viewpoint on the matter. On the other side, many of the people who are the leaders of the pro-life community have people in their lives who were quote unquote almost aborted. So Flip Benham, who was the head of Operation Rescue, he told me how when his wife got pregnant, he wanted her to have an abortion. She refused to. She then gave birth to twin boys who are now, like any of us, the sort of, you know, loves of this man's life, which informed his thinking on the matter. So my book tries to humanize everything, help us see abortion for the complicated issue that it really is. And yes, it will. those issues are not going anywhere, even after the Supreme Court rules on Dobbs in June.
So, and you're right, by the way, Harry Blackmun, who wrote the decision in this case, not only a Republican appointee, but he kind of shifted his, as some justices do over time, when they, you know, you get on the bench and all of a sudden you see the world differently. But here's the thing. When the decision comes down in June, hopefully I'll get you back on my show and we'll see you everywhere at that time. So let me ask you a question that you'll probably be asked at that time. Certainly I would ask, which is, all right, now we know what the decision is. It's whatever they do. How does the family, two parts. Number one, how do you feel if the justices on the current Supreme Court, and think about that group, Amy Coney Barrett and the rest of them, if they had read the family row, how would it have informed their decision, given what you just said, the personal experiences of Blackmun, of Powell, did inform what they were doing? How would this book, if we got all of them to read it, inform their decision as they contemplate this?
It's a good question. You know, I think, unfortunately, when it comes to abortion, a lot of times the tail wags the dog. We know how we're going to sort of opine on something or rule on something, and then we sort of, you know, cater our constitutional analysis to that, our political views to that. But as you correctly noted, Justice Blackmun did change his thinking on it over the years. It went from being focused on the rights of doctors, for example, to the rights of women. It went from being focused on rooting the right to an abortion in privacy to rooting it to one in equality. And I won't be shocked if some of these justices migrate over time. And I do think it's important for them to sort of, you know, read my book. It's very easy, for example, to say, oh, you know, I oppose abortion even in cases of rape and incest, when you're just thinking about something in abstract terms. But when you see what that does to real human lives, it's difficult to do that. And my book makes the human cost of these policies quite clear. And so I do hope that they read the book. And, you know, you never know. We were sure, people were sure that abortion, that Roe was going to be overturned in 1992 in the case of Planned Parenthood v. Casey, and it wasn't. It was another Republican appointee, Justice Souter, who sort of behind the scenes brought two other justices to his side, Kennedy and O'Connor, and they sort of engineered an 11th hour rescue of Roe. And, you know, will it be the most shocking thing in the world if that happens again? No, it can happen again. And we never know. In that case, it was a memo, actually, written by a clerk that changed Justice Souter's opinion, a memo that I got my hands on and write about in the book. And who knows? Maybe it will be something that they read. Maybe even my book. One never knows.
You know, after Souter, of course, sort of shifted his view of the world, there's a phrase that I know you know it, and Republicans refer to it, is they don't ever want to get Souter'd again, meaning you never want to put somebody on the court who will then surprise you. And certainly the Trump picks haven't done that. Actually, Harry Blackmun might have been the first one before Souter. They could have said, we don't want to be Blackmun'd again. That one never caught on. But let me ask you, since you started this process in 2010, the book just came out this year, 2021. That's an 11-year process. And I understand you finished it prior to publication and all that. But did you, and how did you change over the course of the, did you go into it with a certain mindset? And after you did all your work and wrote the book, you went, huh, I see life differently now.
I was changed by the process. You're right. I, too, was changed. And I'll tell you where I am on this. My ideal in terms of if I were, you know, king and could sort of make the law, what I thought, I think the ideal is what they have in Western Europe, where the line, the legal cutoff for abortion is actually earlier in a pregnancy than we have it. It is closer to the 15 weeks that they have in Mississippi. But here's the major difference than from what we have here. Until that legal cutoff, let's say it's 13, 14, 15 weeks, the state does not impose restrictions on the woman wanting to have an abortion. Rather, it helps her to have an abortion. Abortion is free. It's available almost everywhere. It is, you know, they don't subject the woman to sort of unnecessary tests. They don't tell her that abortion causes cancer. They don't make her have sort of signed consent forms from her husband or boyfriend or a doctor. So it's a very different thing. And of course, there are, even in those Western European states, laws saying that, hey, and if the abortion actually poses danger, is a threat to the life of the, you know, pregnant woman, then she can have the abortion. So that to me is sort of the ideal. And I hadn't really thought about that when I started my book.
when you see what has happened, which is over the course of you writing the book, you know, abortion ends up on the front headlines, it made me think about the fact that, well, two things can happen. Number one, you now know Governor Gavin Newsom in California is thinking of playing the Texas game with gun rights. You know, hey, let's make everybody vigilante about gun rights. And then number two, there's many people who believe that if the Supreme Court does away with abortion rights, get ready, same-sex marriage is on its way for potential reversal, that at least as progressives feel that way. So my question for you is, as you, I don't know if you're working on another project now, but given what happened here, have you considered the fact saying, you know what, maybe a book about Jim Obergefell and his husband and, you know, the events of that issue, or maybe a book about Heller and in the gun case? Are those in your agenda? Are you now sparked by something issue wise that may go the way that the Roe versus Wade is going?
So I'll tell you something. First of all, if Roe v. Wade is overturned and then the court does sort of shift its focus to same-sex marriage, I will not be surprised if the sort of liberal side of things, if they're in power, says, you know what, this has gone too far, we're going to add justices to the court. Like, I think it would be, the reaction would be that seismic, that the liberal side would say, hey, we're going to do something no less radical than you've just done. In terms of what I'm focusing on, I'll tell you, writing about abortion and Roe all these years was utterly exhausting. When you call someone up and you want to talk to them about it, it's always difficult. It's never just sort of an easy interview. It was an exhausting process, and I don't have it in me to do something like that again. But my next project is actually connected to law. I am writing, here's a little teaser, I've found, again, something unknown, just like I mentioned the Roe baby. I found something fascinating, unknown, connected to Harvard Law School and World War II. And that is what I'm writing about next. It's not a book, but it's a long article. And again, what fascinates me is looking behind the headlines to sort of say, hey, you know what? History is more complicated than we like to say it is. Everything is gray. It's not black and white. And it's in that gray zone that I think sort of truth resides.
Well, you've now, of course, intrigued me. I have to start going to the Google and figuring out what what it is you might be looking at.
We'll talk in the spring.
All right. And Joshua, again, I have to congratulate. Look, I've written 15 books myself. I don't think I've changed anybody's life with any of them. But when you read The Family Road American Story, it really has an impact. And the timeliness, man, you couldn't have paid a PR person to have made the timing of this book work any better. That's crazy. I'm sorry that it is working that way. It's an amazing book. And Joshua Prager, congratulations to you on an absolutely fascinating story. I encourage everybody to read it. I read it cover to cover, and it's just fascinating. And you know what? I'm going to wait for your article in the spring. Thank you, my friend. I appreciate the incredible journalism you live.
Thank you very much. It's really nice of you to have me on. Thank you.
Well, if you want to know more about what we've talked about here, follow me on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, at Paul Lisnek. That's PaulLisnek. And I'd love to hear your comments or topic suggestions for future podcasts. You can also go to my website, paullisnek.tv. And hey, don't forget to hit subscribe on WGN Plus and iTunes. And tune in each week to hear more insider scoop coming to you from behind the curtain.